This is the DiGressio podcast of Roman Roads Press, helping Christian families inherit the humanities. I'm Cooper Sama, and I do video marketing, and I'm here with Daniel Fugashan, Roman Roads founder.
Hi.
Joining us today is Christiana Hale, the author of our most recent book, Deeper Heaven, A Reader's Guide to C.S. Lewis's Ransom Trilogy.
Hi, nice to be here.
And I just want to check, I did get the pronunciation right.
You did, I think so. Christiana.
Okay. Yes. Very good.
So, Christiana, I want to introduce you a bit, but before I do that, I want to read the last paragraph of the foreword by Douglas Wilson to your book, Deeper Heaven. So, Christiana Hale is particularly suited to the task of writing A Reader's Guide to the Ransom Trilogy. She is an intelligent lover of all things Lewis and is a dedicated student of this material. She reads carefully, widely, and wisely, and is not hampered by having to read her material with modernist blinkers that help us all to deny what the texts are obviously saying. I've been privileged to have known Christiana as a student in a number of settings, and this book is one that I can happily commend and recommend. You will always come away from it the wiser. So,
Far too nice.
So tell us a bit about yourself and the journey to becoming a lover of all things Lewis and having another Lewis scholar say that of you.
Yeah, well, my Lewis journey, you might say, started, as many of ours do, with the Chronicles of Narnia, and with my mother reading them to us before bed and just, you know, curled up and couldn't wait for the next chapter. And I remember, you know, loving the Chronicles of Narnia growing up and then not really knowing that Lewis wrote anything else. For a really long time, which I think is true for a lot of people. They know him as a children's author, and they love those books. They grew up with them, and then, you know, they get older, they go to high school. Maybe if they go to a Christian high school, they might encounter some of his apologetic works, which I did once I reached high school was when my family discovered classical Christian education. And so I kind of started reading a little bit more of Lewis, but it really wasn't until college. I came to Moscow almost 10 years ago now, and went to NSA, and that's when I
what
really...
What is NSA?
New St. Andrews College, right?
Not the National Security Agency.
No. Here in Moscow, it's a classical Christian liberal arts college, and that's when I encountered the Ransom Trilogy for the first time.
Okay, so. And what a testimony of the importance of reading aloud. You know, so many people will attribute their parents reading aloud to them.
Yes. I'm so grateful for that in so many ways. But yes, the Ransom Trilogy was assigned in freshman year rhetoric at New St. Andrews. And that, what's funny is I had actually tried to read it years before when I was probably 13 or 14. And I read the first maybe two chapters and couldn't get any further. I was bored to tears. And then
which book?
The Out of the Silent Planet, the first book of the trilogy. Then freshman year NSA, I realized, oh no, I have to read the whole thing. And what's funny is I was very homesick my freshman year and had a hard time and honestly almost gave up a few times. It was a lot of work. And the Ransom Trilogy is what convinced me I'm going to stay all 4 years.
Because
I decided the first time reading it, I'm going to write my thesis on this.
I didn't realize it was that early.
It really wasn't. It's been nine year journey with Ransom. So I also credit that with, you know, getting me through my undergraduate years and helping me decide to go for a master's degree. And obviously, just kind of snowballed from there, that project.
Right. So your experience of starting the Ransom Trilogy and then not just stumbling and not getting through it is actually quite common. Actually, that's the case with myself. And New St. Andrews had not added the Ransom Trilogy to freshman rhetoric when I was going through NSA, which I am a little bitter about, actually, because
they didn't make you read it.
I actually did stall. And so I've read the Ransom Trilogy very slowly over a few years, where I read Out of the Silent Planet, kind of stumbled on Paralandra, and then more recently, only very recently, read That Hideous Strength.
Wow.
So, yes, I'm so glad it's part of the curriculum now. Very important. And more people need to read it. So let's actually talk about that. Why why does the Ransom Trilogy need a reader's guide? You know, that's, I think we partially answered it just by saying that people do stumble, but you want to talk about that. Why do they stumble? And then how is this book going to help them?
Yeah. Well, I think firstly, the trilogy kind of defies categories, really. And that is part of what people have a hard time with. I think they go into it with certain expectations, partly due to people calling it the space trilogy. Because right away you call it that and you think, this is sci-fi. And then it doesn't really feel like sci-fi. And there's all sorts of weird things, especially as you keep going through it. I think Out of the Silent Planet is the most sci-fi of the three, because there's space travel, there's a spaceship, they're on another planet.
Aliens.
There are species that are very different from humans. But then you get to Paralandra, and for one thing, angels take him to Paralandra, and there's no real spaceship with science behind it.
Right.
And then there's just a green lady, and there's talking, lots of talking, and philosophical discussions, and there's this creepy man that's been possessed, and you are just very confused. And then that his strength is a whole another story, and there's Merlin and a bear, and you know. So I think that the problem does come in by calling it science fiction to start with, and understanding Lewis's background and what he was actually trying to do with the trilogy is essential to understanding how all of those different pieces fit together.
Yeah.
And so part of why I decided to write this book was when I was writing my undergraduate thesis on the Ransom trilogy, which was more narrow. It was a smaller thesis. It was more of a specific topic. I got so many people asking me, why are you doing that on this book? And I tried reading that book and I gave up and it was so weird and Merlin.
You're right.
Just really. And so I found myself, you know, consistently answering that question and realizing that I didn't really have a place to point them as far as what to read. You know, where can you go to actually just get some basic information on the background to these books and what Lewis was trying to do? And so I decided, well, maybe I should just write one myself and try to fill that space.
Well, I want to get into there we go. So I want to get into the space trilogy as the name of it, but let's back up a little bit to what is the circumstance in which it was written? I know it involves Tolkien, so how did he come about writing it? And then let's talk about the name.
Yes. Yeah, so Lewis and Tolkien were having a conversation about that there were not very many books or stories of the kind that they both enjoyed, and lamenting that fact. And of course, you know, being the geniuses that they were, there aren't stories we like, so let's write them ourselves. And so they kind of had this bet going on that Lewis would write a space story and Tolkien would write a time travel story, which he never did. He kind of started one. It was called The Lost Road, and it was meant to connect his Lord of the Rings world, or the Middle Earth, to our time. But he kind of started one, but it never really got traction on it.
What a shame.
I know. He was probably being too perfectionistic, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. He tended to
the perfectionists
to do that.
Among us.
It does seem like Tolkien's flaw.
Yeah.
Too precise.
Yes. Yeah. And then Lewis, on the other hand, very, very characteristic, went above and beyond, and he wrote a trilogy of space travel stories. So, and I think, you know, he was a medieval and Renaissance scholar, and so the medieval cosmology was something he was already very familiar with and very fond of. And as other scholars have argued, Michael Ward in particular, he worked that through the majority of his fiction. But I think this is where it comes up front and center, really, which is obvious when you start looking at it, but so many people miss it. And I think that really is the key to understanding what he's doing in this trilogy is his love for the medieval Renaissance literature and for the cosmology in particular.
Mm. Right. So he loved space.
Yes, in a sense.
So depending go ahead on and your, just destroy on what your, I just said.
Yes. So really, I mean, and it is funny because in the end of Out of the Silent Planet, the very last, you know, epilogue or postscript, I think he calls it, he even says, this is, you know, this is what we're trying to do, which is get our reader to to move over from a conception of space back to a conception of the heavens. And he says it in a letter to one of his readers that actually pointed out that she enjoyed that aspect of the books. He said, that's actually my favorite thing. And that's what I'm trying to do. And is to return to that older way of thinking. And I would argue a biblical way of thinking. That's how the Bible talks about it. It talks about the heavens, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament displays his handiwork. And that actually is how we are supposed to think about the night sky when we look up at it. What do we see? And that the term space, Lewis was not very fond of, because it has all sorts of connotations that go along with it. Very modernistic, materialistic connotations. And so it's not just a word, but it actually encompasses a worldview. And right. So that is what he was really trying to use in this trilogy. And I think he does it to great effect and has influenced a lot of people.
Like space is just emptiness. It's just the filler stuff. There's not much there.
Yes.
Something like that. It's just kind of this void.
Dead and cold. Yes. Mm. Nothing living out there at all.
What? I remember there was a scene in the trilogy somewhere where Ransom is discovering, oh, space is not, that's not the best word for it. Do you know what I'm thinking of?
Yeah, it's very early on in Out of the Silent Planet. I think it's chapter 4 or 5. So, it's near the beginning when he's been kidnapped by two characters, Weston and Divine, and he's in their spaceship, and it is nothing like what he expected. And first he's terrified when he realizes, because he's been knocked out and abducted. So he wakes up on the spaceship he doesn't know where he is at first. And when he realizes that he's seeing the Earth from outside, from space, he just has this he's terrified of it.
Right, yeah.
And then as they move through what he calls space, he starts to, that conception starts to fall away from him because of the light coming from the sun, which has a very particular influence, which is something that Lewis talks a lot about, it, which I talk a lot about in my book, is what the influence of the planets. It's a very personal and a living thing. So, so that starts to have a huge effect on his perception. And that is, I think, a turning point for him. And I think it's a turning point for the reader as well. And that's one of the most important, I'd say, crucial chapters of, it's very early on that comes. And then that point is where the fundamental change and shift starts to happen. And then it continues throughout the rest of the trilogy.
So he is himself undergoing this metamorphosis of kind of, you know, coming from the, from Earth, coming out of the silent planet. Mm-hmm. And it's his own journey of realization. Can you talk a little bit about, like, so it, this is a, in terms of the Copernican versus Ptolemaic view and what's going on there, can you unpack those terms and explain it?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting what Lewis does, because he does not rearrange the cosmos. So he doesn't go back entirely to a Ptolemaic view of the universe. So he's not like, he rejects all of our scientific discoveries, and he doesn't argue that, oh, no, Earth is central. So when Ransom goes to Malacandra, which is Mars, at the end, near the end, actually, he encounters one of the species he's carving out a picture of the cosmos and the order, and he gives the order of the planets, and it's our order. It is, the sun is actually at the center. And so Lewis, it doesn't, in the book at least, he's not trying to, you know, overturn. Basically, he's trying to wed the cosmology in terms of the worldview and how the medievals viewed the way the cosmos works with our physical layout that we have and what we've learned. But the important thing to notice, I think, is Earth's place in this cosmos, which is, it's important to understand too what the medievals thought about the centrality of Earth, because a lot of people, and this leads to the whole Galileo story and the misunderstanding there too, is that a lot of people think, oh, the medievals, they put man at the center because mankind is so important and he's the, you know, the highest highest being in creation and so lofty, and so he needs to be at the center, right. And it's all about mankind, but
which is an enlightenment.
Yes, yes, much more enlightenment. And as Lewis says in The Discarded Image, he talks about this concept that the central point is actually for the medievals the lowest and right. most humble position, mm-hmm. which we see very clearly in Dante's Divine Comedy, with hell being at the center of earth, right? Earth is the center of the cosmos, and hell mm-hmm. is the center of the center, the lowest of the low.
And Satan's in the middle of that.
Yes, and Satan is the center of hell. So
you don't want to be in the center.
So the center is actually not, the center is Satan's feet, really, which you do not want to ever be. So so mankind is actually located at the most humble place that you could be in the mm. cosmos. And what Lewis saw in the medieval cosmology is actually a discord between man's central place in the cosmos as being the lowest, and then Christianity's argument that the incarnation has come and actually granted mankind an importance that cannot be really overstated. I mean, God became man right. and dwelt among us, and the highest became the lowest, which is this huge juxtaposition that medieval Christians actually struggled with, because their whole cosmology placed man at this low, really low, unimportant place, and then suddenly the incarnation comes in and changes everything. So Lewis actually argued that that's a discordant thing that kind of does not ring very true in the trilogy, in the cosmology. Right. And he didn't, he's like, this is one thing that just doesn't really fit. And I think that the Ransom trilogy is his attempt to actually rectify that.
Right. So to pierce the sublunar, out of yes. the silent planet. So, I want to come back to that, but, as you were saying that, I was thinking of, of course, we're at Roman Roads. We love the term Old Western Culture, which was coined by Lewis.
Yes.
And he makes the bold claim in On the Description of Times that pre-Christian man and medieval man had more in common than post-Enlightenment man. And I've said that many times. I've thought about that, but I wonder if this is more important than I realized to it. The effect the incarnation had. This is something pre-Christian and medieval man really held in common. So the incarnation meant something mm-hmm. to the place of man that the Enlightenment man, which was different for the Enlightenment man.
Yeah, yeah. That it actually.
Am I on the right track there?
Yeah, well, I think so. I think so that the incarnation, I think we, and this is, we are children of the Enlightenment, really.
Right.
I mean, we're downstream from it.
And we need to understand where we've come
yes,
from in Old Western culture.
Yes, mm. which is why
our curriculum.
I read Lewis, too. Yes, and so I think we take the incarnation far too much for granted, and we're mm-hmm. not as amazed
by
it and shocked yeah. that it was actually, it was a scandalous thing, really.
Right.
The fact that God became man and dwelt
right.
among us on this planet, and it really turned the whole cosmos inside out. I mean, it was just a total reversal of what they thought the cosmos looked like,
all
and
the
they had it all organized. and I think that there's a lot to be said for that organization, and I think that they had a better perspective on what the incarnation really meant for our planet and for the human race than we do, because we just kind of assume, well, yes, of course, man is the cream of the, I mean, we're not that great. We're not that great. I mean, clearly needed salvation. I mean, we right. needed Christ to come, mm-hmm. but I mean, of course he would become a man. Right. I mean,
right. Because man is the center of the universe
yeah.
In the post-Enlightenment
yeah,
sense.
Exactly.
Man is
the best thing.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And no, he became, I mean, we think we're the best anthill around, but he still became an ant, you know,
right.
I mean, this is tiny, tiny. Yeah. So
yeah,
I think that it was much more dramatic of a thing for the medievals to grapple with. And they had a hard time grappling with it, which is why Lewis talks about there being that discord in an otherwise very harmonious system, which he loved. He loved the order and organization and harmony of the medieval cosmos. And so that discord really stands out. And he talks about that quite a bit, which is what I think he had in mind when he was working on the Ransom trilogy, to be honest. Mm.
So can you talk about the direction related to this that the trilogy takes place in? So first of all, Mars and Venus and Earth, respectively, for the three books. And then, you know, so with that in mind, you know, so how with his idea of the cosmos, tell us about the direction and the movement between those planets.
Yes. Well, so in obviously keeping in mind that there are different orders of the planets. So Lewis is using our order, in which case Mars is somewhere in the middle. Venus is the farthest from Earth, and then there's Mars, and then us. But he had the medieval order of the planets in mind. And so right. I think that it does have, there's that kind of trajectory there where Mars in the medieval cosmos is the farthest out, and then Venus is actually closer, and then Earth is obviously central, lowest and central. And so I think that Lewis had that in mind because there is this sense in which the fight is becoming more intense and it's drawing nearer till in the final book, it's finally here on our planet.
And for Lewis, it was literally his backyard.
Yes. You know, yeah. Right there happening.
And you get that feel.
Yes. Yes, definitely. And even in just the stories that are told. So in the first one, you have all these different creatures that are, you know, they are sentient beings, but they're very unlike man, which is something that Ransom has to kind of grapple with because it undoes a lot of his preconceived ideas about what extraterrestrials are like.
Right.
Right. Because by definition, if they are not man-like, then they are therefore somehow horrifying or cruel or less moral. And so he has to grapple with that, all of that in the first book. And that is, so that book primarily, I believe, is about him just his whole worldview shifting. Right. And he's on Mars, which has an influence, obviously, on him as a person, as a character. He spends that book becoming more and more martial, which is preparing him for the next book, Paralandra, which, again, has a totally different feel than the first book and is near Earth both in the medieval cosmology, but also in he's talking to a woman who very much looks like a woman. I mean, she's green, but she's otherwise, she's called, you know, he calls her the Green Lady. So she is otherwise very human-like. And it is paralleling our story, the Adam and Eve story of the fall, that the temptation of Eve with Satan coming in the form of Weston is the unman. And so there's another parallel where he's drawing closer to Earth until finally, then third book, we are here. We are on Earth itself, on the silent planet, and everything goes crazy. And it gets really exciting.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, I've got one question of clarification. Yeah. When you say the influence of the planets, that's a term we've used a few times.
Yes.
What do you mean exactly?
Yes. Yeah, so in the medieval cosmology, each of the planets had a ruler, and therefore, they exerted an influence or personality because they had a ruler. Each planet had a ruler, and each ruler has a very distinct and different personality. Which, again, because they believed that the spheres above the moon were unfallen, then therefore those influences, those personalities, were so strong that they could pierce below to our fallen Earth and actually have an influence on people, on the Earth. So different metals are associated with the different planets because the influence actually, you know, works its magic in the Earth on people. Actually, we have a holdover from this is the flu, influenza, which means influence in Spanish. And it's called the influenza because they thought it was caused by Saturn, who was the lord of death and sickness and time.
So there are like these rays almost that come from the planets and hit the Earth. And you know what? I think I remember an illustration of some alchemist I think it was of a miser, a medieval illustration of a miser going and turning the dirt in his garden over to expose it to the sun in the hopes of turning it to gold or something like that, these rays of personality coming down and hitting Earth and changing things. And they affect people. Is that what you mean?
They can affect personalities. So they, that's what eventually it morphed into more of an astrology, what we would call astrology today, which is, so depending on when you were born under different planets, you have different personalities. And you know, that's, it's kind of been taken too far and gotten really silly. But at its height in the medieval period, I mean, it was just considered normal that, well, of course, they have an influence and effect. But obviously, because we are fallen and the earth is the lowest and under the moon, and the influence is not pure and undefiled, so that means that it can have some negative effects here on earth. For example, the martial spirit, which above the moon is, again, not sinful, unfallen, here on earth can cause wars and strife and fighting. And so on Mars, actually, when Ransom is talking to the Hrasa, which are one of the species there, he's surprised because they don't have a word for war. They don't have that word. And you stop, wait, you're on Mars. He's the god of war. How do you not have a word for war? Well, it's an unfallen planet. There is no fighting. That doesn't mean there isn't the martial spirit there, but there's more to the martial spirit than just causing wars. But we are familiar with that term here because it's a sinful fallen planet. And so all of the planets have that in their personality, where there's the pure unfallen form and all the personality and the characteristics and traits that go along with that. And here on Earth, we see it never in its purest form, because there's no one who is going to embody perfectly the martial spirit here on Earth, because we are all sinful. And so in this life, at least, we won't see it on this planet.
Right. So I want to connect something that readers of Chronicles of Narnia have so this was very important to Lewis. Mm-hmm. And of course you'll see it in the Chronicles of Narnia. But I feel like he packed so much into this trilogy where, in some senses, I feel like this was his place where he got to talk about things he didn't flesh out in other places. I've had that impression, but, that in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, you know, there's that quote, "In our world," said Eustace, "a star is a huge ball of flaming gas. Even in your world, my son, that is not what a star is, but only what it is made of." And so there's that connection where he's saying that these influences are not just a spiritual realm, you might say. You want to talk about the connection between the physics, the science, the physicality of the stars, and everything we're talking about here in terms of influences. How does Lewis deal with that?
Yeah. So, in the discarded image, and I do talk about this in the book near the end. So, you know, you have to just read the book. Obviously, you always come back to one question about this medieval cosmology as well, but it's not true. Right. And Lewis says that it's not real. It's not true. So why pay attention to it? And his argument is that, well, there's more to being true than just being factually accurate, for one thing. And he recognized that, you know, we're not going to go backwards and pretend that we haven't learned the things we've learned about the stars or the planets or the way the physics work. But that doesn't mean that we can't learn something from the medieval cosmology and that it wasn't true in other ways and in more important ways. And I think I touched on this earlier with talking about how the Bible talks about the heavens and the stars. And so that quote there from the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, I think is a great one, because it's the same thing as in the Bible. We have a star that leads the way to the manger in Bethlehem. Right. And you think, well, but you know, if you're thinking just purely scientifically, how is that possible? I mean, we have these three wise men in there on their camels, and do they have all their star charts out, and are they doing complex algebraic equations on the back of their camel in the dark to try to figure out the exact house in the exact town even? How do you get to one town by following a star? And then it says the star stood over the house where Jesus lay, and how did it not burn up the entire city? I mean, this is a star we're talking about. How did it get close enough to point out one house? And that's because it was an angel, not a star. I mean, you know, and if we read through the Bible, that's how the Bible talks about the heavenly hosts. What are the heavenly hosts? They're stars that came down and saying. And now, does that mean that if you went up in a spaceship and actually went to the star that you would see an angel standing there? Well, probably not. But ultimately, again, it comes down to how do we view reality? Is it all material and it's just right. what we can touch? Well, we know that's not true because, well, even those who say it is, they really know it's not because you're talking and you're using words to communicate information, which means by definition, this is actually a spiritual reality because if there were no spiritual reality, we could not actually communicate right now with words because words are intangible and have meaning beyond just the sound waves and the physical elements. So I think that that's, I mean, again, as Lewis said, going back to a conception of the heavens as opposed to space, it's not that he's saying if you go up in a spaceship like Ransom did, you will actually see sunshine. Because we have sent astronauts up and we know that's not true. He's saying, what do you actually think about the way that God made the world? Yeah. And he made it far more than just atoms and enzymes and sacks of plasma.
So. Right. So the trilogy takes place on Mars, Venus, and Earth. How it's connected to all this, how does tell us about Lewis's term, donegality.
Yes. So actually, Lewis did not himself coin that term and use it in the way that I use it in the book. That credit goes to Michael Ward, who first used it in this way. So Lewis is talking about his favorite stories and why does he go back again and again to certain books? And he says he goes back to them for the same reason you go back to certain places. You go to Paris because it feels a certain way. You go to London for its Londonness and to Donegal, which is a county in Ireland, for its Donegality.
That's where the term comes from.
So that's where the term. Actually,
it's a somewhat funny phrase. Yes. So I was like, is there Latin there?
Yeah, okay, no, Donegal. Place. Yeah, is a county in Ireland. So then Michael Ward picks up that term and then he kind of uses it to refer to that thing that Lewis is talking about, which I think you could also call atmosphere. I like the word donegality because it's fun, but it is, why do you want to reread a book? Well, because you want to live in the world of that book again. It feels different than any other book that you've read.
Tolkien really gets this.
Yes, he does. You want to go to the Shire. You read the Hobbit.
The Shire is a place.
Yeah.
It's real.
It is.
I've been there.
Yes, and you can always go back. That's why,
that's
honestly why I think Lewis is right, that's why you reread books. Because once you know the story, like, well, why would I read it again? I mean, and some of them are just, you want to go through that experience with those characters. But a lot of times, the strongest reason is you want to return to that place. And just like different places have a different atmosphere, you know, you could even just, I use this example with my students, actually, you know, you could walk into your grandma's house and probably could blindfold you and take you to your grandma's house and have you walk in and you'd probably know, this is my grandma's house. That's smell and that's feel and that's this intangible thing that's hard to put your finger on.
Sounds,
just everything that combines to make it the place that it is. And the same thing goes for books, that a good author who really grasps this can capture that feeling and weave it into his story. Yeah. And that has far more to do than with just the plot. I mean, the plot is part of it, but the characters, all the details, all the descriptions, just everything working together to make that a place that you want to be.
Yeah. I mean, you're describing that and I can picture my grandparents' house in France that has, you know, they've lived in the same place for 60 plus years, probably a lot longer now. This is, I guess, a little bit of a tangent, but what a tragedy it is if people don't value place to the point where they're always moving. And I'm thinking about the effect of donegality or lack thereof when people go to old folks' homes, you know, they're removed from that. You know, it's just like they're losing something very tangible, which I think donegality is describing a bit.
Yeah.
So,
which I think is tied. I mean, it's tied very closely to personality too. Is that a place feels the way it does a lot of times because of the people that live there, the people that are there, which ties into Lewis's use of the planets in his use of Donegality.
Their influences. So it's a place is more than just a physical location.
Exactly.
On Google Maps and the atoms that make it. It has a spirit, if you will.
Yeah.
I was about to say spirit, but I think it works.
Spirit as far as, you know, what animates it, what gives it, what gives it life, what makes it a living place as opposed to a dead place, which I think we know. I mean, even if it's hard to describe, I think we know what that feels like when you, it's like walking into a show house, you know, when people are showing their homes and, but they have already moved out and they hire someone to come in and decorate it and clean it. And it's just, it's sterile. And you can feel no one is living here.
The soul is gone.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and you know, I think showing houses is a good example, actually. So if you go into a house that someone does live in and they've done a, you know, it's a warm, inviting place that has an influence, an effect on your experience of that place. Like, oh, this is really, really nice. Yeah. But what will it be like when you move all that furniture out and put your own in, right? So Dr. Ward's thesis in Planet Narnia is his very, very excellent book, which was a big inspiration behind me wanting to write this book. His argument is looking at specifically the Chronicles of Narnia and arguing how Lewis uses the Donegality of each of the planets to influence the atmosphere of each of the seven books, which line up with the seven planets. So those books came later, obviously, after the Ransom Trilogy. And I think yes, he wrote the Ransom Trilogy first. And I think they overlap. No, they may not. Now I have to double check my dates. I'm really bad at remembering dates. I know that the Ransom Trilogy came first. And I don't think they overlap, but the Chronicles of Narnia, I think, start soon after.
Speaking of that, I need to point out one of the really neat features of this book are the appendices. There are three appendices. I don't want to lose your train of thought.
No, it's
I just
okay.
wanted, as you were thinking, Dave's like, we can look that up.
Yes, we can look it up. The book's right here.
And the appendix one is a timeline, the life and writing of C.S. Lewis. And each of the seven sections of the book are illustrated by a planet.
Yes, which does actually make sense, but I'll leave you to decode that.
So you have to get the book to see.
Yeah,
then appendix B is the going through all the terms, so in alphabetical order. And C is allusions, quotations, and translations, an index.
Which I've got to say that once I heard that was going to be a part of this, I was like, oh, wow, I've got to get that done. I've got to get it. Just every single reference.
That was a project. I'll tell you, that could have been a project all in its own. And I'm sure it's probably not comprehensive. There will be things. I'm sure you'll get emails saying, wait, you missed this. But yes, that was something I was really excited to include because as far as I could tell, I don't think you can really find it. There's some internet sources. I did find one internet source where someone had kind of compiled some of them, which was helpful to kind of point me in the right direction. But then I wanted to track down all the sources myself, which was a lot of footwork. So some people had done some work that put me on the right track, but they were missing a lot. There was no comprehensive as far as I could tell. And so this is as comprehensive an index of all of the times that Lewis refers to anything that is already in existent literature or historical fact or a quote from a written work, Bible quotations and allusions, which is a lot. You realize he did this a lot, especially that hideous strength. It's everywhere. And so it's quite a task, but it's really exciting to have that all in one spot.
I totally derailed where you were
going. It's okay. It's okay. So I was talking about the Ransom Trilogy predating Chronicles of Narnia. And so I think the Ransom Trilogy is his exposition, if you will, in novel form of his love for the medieval cosmos. And then the Chronicles of Narnia is him using it in a different way. So it's very front and center in the Ransom Trilogy. This is what I'm doing. He talks about it right out there. And the planets are very present. I mean, they even come down, right? The spirits of the planets come down in the third book, in this wonderful, wonderful chapter. And then the Chronicles of Narnia, I think, is where he's attempting to do it use the influence, use the medieval cosmology in a very hidden way, which is what Dr. Ward talks about in his book, that this is the hidden thing behind those books that actually makes them work when they really shouldn't. Like, why is Father Christmas in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Why is he in Narnia at all? Why does Mrs. Beaver have a sewing machine? Isn't that anachronistic? And it actually works, and it all worked. And why are they so beloved, and why have they lasted when it seems like he just threw...
how did it get so popular? Exactly.
Yeah, you know, how did it get so popular?
And yet they're so different. There's a different feel
to each book.
I mean, The Horse and His Boy and Prince Caspian, and I mean, they're just so different. Mm. So because the Chronicles of Narnia are so much more read... can you point out one of the books and kind of show the domingality going on?
Yes. Like, yeah. How to choose. Yeah, I really could talk about any of them. But The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, let's pick that one because I really enjoyed that book. And so the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the domingality is influenced by the sun.
Okay.
That's the book associated with Sol, the sun, which it's in the title, Dawn, the Dawn Treader, references the sun for one thing. But then the more you dig into the solar imagery and all of the mythology associated with the sun, you start to see more threads come out. So Apollo is the sun god in Greek mythology, and he's the god of gold, obviously. Well, gold is associated with the sun, and he's also the god he's associated with wisdom, music, learning, literature, and he also was known as the dragon slayer, Apollo Sarachthonos in the Greek. He's killed the python, right? And so dragons are actually very closely connected with Apollo, which you see that right away on the ship itself has the prow of a dragon. And then
the sun's on the sails, right?
Yes. And then you have the dragon, Eustis turns into a dragon. And so dragons pop up fairly frequently.
Oh, the sea monster.
The sea monster is also another dragon. Yeah. You have the gold, the planet Deathwater Island with the gold. So the gold is very, very present. The jealousy, the envy, desire for riches.
Miserliness?
There's another word.
Lust for gold?
Yes. I feel like there's one word that is escaping me, and it's going to come to us, and it'll be really obvious. That is, you know, the influence of the sun that's been twisted here on Earth. So the gold island, you know, that's very... very solar.
Right.
And then you have all these wise men, the stars, one thing. But you have the retired star, Coriacan, who is a sorcerer, but he's wishing for wisdom. He's trying to govern his duffel puds in wisdom, but it's, you know, very difficult.
With and so, success.
And then you have the other star. I'm losing his name now. Ramandu, right? Ramandu's island. And he's also a star, and he's very wise. So the wisdom is present there, all the people that guide them along their journey, and even Caspian's journey itself, the fact that he's trying to fulfill an oath, you know, but he's also trying to learn. He wants to go to the end of the world, right? That's kind of a secondary goal, is to discover these new islands. And so,
how does Reepicheep fit in?
Oh, Reepicheep. Well, Reepicheep fits in because he's Reepicheep. And he's awesome.
But actually, as far as more sun affecting things, when they get close to the end of their voyage, the water changes. Was that because of this? Was that a solar
They are growing near to the edge of the world where the sun, there's no more night, right? Mm. The night is gone. It's just sunlight. It lights up the water. The water is sweet. So I think that's all. I mean, it's kind just getting brighter and brighter and brighter. You're basically getting nearer and nearer to the sun. So that's just that's kind of the end of the journey, is also solar, the sun. So, and there's probably more that could be unpacked there. I'm sure those are just the things that I'm remembering. Planet Narnia. It is excellent. There's also, he did write a shorter book called The Narnia Code, which is a lot thinner and a little bit less academic. It doesn't have as much of the background, and so that's just a brief introduction, really, if you want just to see how do each of the seven books align with a planet and how are they influenced. That's a fun read too. Planet Narnia is pretty thick and it's great. It's excellent. But if you want just a quick flyby, there's a shorter version.
So related to that, there's a certain purpose here to be a guide to people who are reading the Ransom trilogy. Between the Narnia Code and Planet Narnia, who is this book for?
Yes. So my book, Deeper Heaven, I would say is for anyone who wants to read the trilogy but is scared to, who has started to read the trilogy but gave up, or who has read the trilogy and is just very confused, which I think probably covers everyone, covers almost everyone, right?
I already, someone right as we were finishing the book, there was a... someone on Facebook who did exactly that. They started in, they're like, and he posted and said, okay, tell me why I shouldn't give up. And so I actually promised him a copy. I'm going to be sending him one.
Yes.
That's very common.
If you're a medieval scholar and you got every single reference and you already know everything, this is probably not the book for you. That if you already know everything.
If you know everything, well, why are you reading anything then? You're just done reading books if you know everything. I really wanted it to be accessible.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking homeschool moms or homeschool teachers who are going through it with their students and don't really have much of a background in medieval and Renaissance literature and they want to be introduced or want to figure out what is going on. And so I wanted to write a guide in such a way that really anyone could pick it up and hopefully learn something. Hopefully.
So if someone is wanting to teach through this, how would they use this book?
Yeah. So I did organize it in sections according to each of the three books. So it's easy to kind of treat each one almost like a unit. I would say that you would want to probably read the book first, as far not my book, the trilogy. So read Out of the Silent Planet, and then maybe go read the section
part one
of Deeper Heaven and Paralandra part two, so on and so forth. So there are reader discussion questions at the end of each section too. They are discussion questions, meaning that there's not necessarily a right or wrong answer. It's meant to spark discussion between you and your students, between you and whoever's in your reading group, if you're doing just a study group with some friends. Just these are things that maybe you could be thinking about as you're working your way through it. So, yeah, and there's obviously lots of other ways you could use this book, but that would be one possible way to lead a group through it.
Okay, well thank you. I wanted to read just a few of the table of contents.
Oh, yeah,
just to give an idea of the kind of how you approach the book, because... I'll just read a few here. So, part one, Out of the Silent Planet, chapter four is the pedestrian and the pilgrim, Dante's influence. So, yeah. Chapter five, by Jove, Lewis's use of language. Chapter six, the heavens declare, Ransom's revelation. Chapter seven, strange fiction, Wells, Lindsay, and the sci-fi genre. I'm going to kind of skip ahead here just to kind of give you the idea. In part two, we have Foreknowledge and Mission, Ransom the Prophet, The End of Silence, Principalities and Powers, Lady of Love, The Influence of Venus, The Language of Paradise, Poetry on Paralandra. So there's a very much a variety. I'm going to skip here to part three. There are 32 chapters. Sorry, 35 chapters. The Hard, Bright, Splendor, Merlin and the Ransom, and Ransom the Elf Friend, Coming to a Point, St. Anne's and Bellbury. So, you know, something that's, you know, definitely about the, you know, directly connected to the book or then thematic. Women of the West, True Femininity, which I remember was, for those who have been reading Digressio magazine, you've been writing for Digressio for a few years. That was, I believe there's a peek at that chapter in Digressio.
Yes, so. Yes. It's been, you know, shined up a bit for the book, but that chapter did start, well, it started in, I wrote this book originally, it was my graduate thesis. So it's been, and it's been polished up quite a bit since then. So graduate thesis, and then there were a couple, at least one chapter that ended up being a Digressio blog post. Mm. So
and this is the Digressio magazine.
Right.
Yes. Yep.
Which has been going on for a few years now, just to clarify.
Yes.
And then just the last two chapters here, the incarnation in the eyes of heaven, man's importance in the cosmos. So we talked about that a bit today. And then recovering the discarded image, looking to the stars. So if you love Lewis, if you have read the Chronicles of Narnia and think want more, read the Ransom Trilogy. Mm. This is a really great guide to it. I've enjoyed reading it.
I've got one quick question, right. because I've got to know this from somebody who. So I think I have read this the whole series, and I've read That Hideous Strength a couple times, listened to it on audiobook, and I struggled with getting into it. You know, you read the sci-fi and you go to the different planets, and then the first it feels like four chapters of That Hideous Strength starts with the inner politics, the inside baseball in a very small college off in the boonies of Great Britain.
Yeah.
So that's a strange start. That seems kind of out of left field. Like, okay, so, and kind of a general question from someone who would know, why is That Hideous Strength so different from the other two? It's the different one, it sticks out.
Yeah.
And it felt like, especially when you get into things like Merlin and some of the strange things that they say, and there are all kinds of reference. I wouldn't be surprised if most of the references in your appendix are of That Hideous Strength.
Yes.
Why is it so different? Why is there so much packed into that one?
Yes. Well, I think there are obviously layers of answer I could give. So firstly, That Hideous Strength was written after Lewis became good friends with Charles Williams. And Charles Williams had a big influence on that book, on a lot of the mythology that kind of got woven into it. So that's just kind of a surface level. It feels different because Lewis himself was a bit different. You know, he's had friendships that shaped him.
The Charles Williams influence.
Yes. So I think that's part of it. I do think there are some very conscious reasons for why the book is different, which it is, because Ransom is actually not front and center anymore in the book. It revolves around Jane and Mark Studdock. And I think that is a conscious decision, and that it makes sense, because that is actually, and you brought up the college and all the inner workings and the politics. That's where the fight starts. It starts with regular people, and it starts in those board discussions. And where are we going as a college? Are we going to sell this land to this company that wants it for who knows what reason, and why, and what's our, and it starts with marriages, real men and real women. And the first word of That Hideous Strength is matrimony. And I think I mentioned in the book is that basically this book is marriage counseling all the way through. It's just, it is this about this relationship between a man and a woman that has gone south, has gone wrong for many reasons. And the whole book is, it's not about them, but it is about them, right? It's centered on them, and they are a picture of a bigger issue. And I think Lewis, so on so many levels, is commenting on so many issues that are still very applicable today, and I think even more so. We live in very tumultuous times, and Lewis understood that. he understood that, and he saw a lot of it coming from miles, or in this case, decades away.
He didn't write that in 2020?
Yeah, exactly.
do you remember what year was That Hideous Strength published? 19?
I think 50
yeah.
something. Okay. Yeah. Again, this is showing my weakness on dates here. this is why I write them in the book and in the timeline, and there they are. I know Out of the Silent Planet was 38. So maybe actually I think 45. Sorry, I think it was 38, 43, 45, I believe.
Oh, okay.
I take that with a grain of salt.
I think that sounds right. I remember being surprised when this was written in 1940 something. This was not right at the end of his life, where it's like in the 60s or something, but.
Yeah.
Before the close of World War II. That is interesting.
Yes. And That Hideous Strength too is, he even says in the beginning of the book that it is a treatment in novel form of what he talks about in his Abolition of Man, The Abolition of Man, which is primarily a critique of a certain sort of education, which just ties into Roman Rhodes and what you guys are doing here, that he was found very concerning and that created a certain type of person, because education ultimately is about creating people and about creating thinkers and people who are going to go out in the world and have an impact and an effect. And so he was concerned with this education that was coming up, and that it was creating men without chests, is his term, which I get into, you know, talk more about what does that actually mean in a chapter in the book. But Mark Studdick is a perfect example in that he has strength of that sort of man, which gratefully he is saved from going as far as he could that direction. But that's what Bellbury represents, is that that establishment that is trying to create men and women who do not actually know how to be humans, how to be people. They are either governed entirely by their heads and their robots and rational people, but they're not really rational, because you end up losing reason. You lose what you make an idol of in the end, right? Or they're completely governed by animalistic appetite and just whatever makes you happy, what you want. And he argued the chest is that central thing that governs both. It's stable. It's the seat of stable emotion. Because we have it both. We have desires. We have just, you know, you're hungry. And if you're hungry, you should eat something. and you also have reason and intellect. But the chest is the third element that is the seat, again, that he defines as the seat of stable emotion, which means organized, regimented emotion. Like, this is how we should feel about this, that governs both reason and appetite and holds them in balance. And that actually creates a well-rounded individual, and that a real human being that interacts with the world the way that they should. And so that his strength is really just showing those two different sides, and also how they can be two sides of the same coin, actually, in the end, with Bellbury, which ironically they are arguing for, you know, a pure science, bodiless existence, right? The head, all the head. But no in chest. The end, they're ending up doing dark magic and listening to this disembodied head, literally a man without a chest, disembodied head, animated by dark spirits. Right. And it's very disturbing, actually. They're doing that. And it's totally, totally antithetical to science or what they thought they were doing, that they're actually worshiping dark spirits. And it's very scary.
Yes. And I'm sorry, now that you mentioned that's a central theme of that hideous strength, am I wrong in remembering that actually trying to transcend humanity, wasn't that a theme in Out of the Silent Planet? The people who kidnap Ransom, isn't that to try to transcend humanity? Wasn't
Weston,
that part of their reasoning?
Yes. So Weston is the scientist who kind of, you know, he created the spaceship and enabled them to make it to Mars. And his philosophy is very interesting, because it does go through some shifts throughout the book. He starts out by, he actually wants humanity to just survive. Survival of the species is kind of the ultimate good, which is why he's trying to get to other planets, because he's worried, you know, our planet is, you know, we're destroying it, and so we need to expand. We need to spread throughout the universe. But by the time we get to Paralandra, he shows up on Paralandra, his philosophy has gone through some significant changes.
Does he appear on Paralandra, though?
Well, he does. I think he does. When he first arrives, I think it is him still. Though he's dabbled in things that he ought not to have dabbled in. And I think there is a moment, there's this scene where he opens himself fully up to being possessed. And I think after that moment, he is actually no longer present.
He's gone.
Weston as an individual, as a man, is been completely or pretty much completely eradicated. He might be down there somewhere. And he might pop up occasionally, but I think for the most part, it's no longer no longer Weston. And that's when Ransom starts calling him the Unman instead of Weston, because he sees that has happened. And at that point, though, in his first conversations with Ransom, you can see that his philosophy has has changed since the first book, and we don't know exactly what he's been doing or where he's been going, but clearly nothing good has happened. If you end up getting possessed by the devil, you've done some things that you ought to.
You went wrong.
You really shouldn't. Something happened.
Red flag.
Yes.
Red flag.
Major red flag. Yes. So, and his philosophy, I mean, that is, was the driving engine for Bellbury then. And so his philosophy keeps going even after he's gone. It was the driving engine behind the NICE and Bellbury. But again, you see that it has shifted, and that people state, you know, they state a certain purpose, but they're not consistent in that purpose. Right. And ultimately it always gets twisted and warped. When you put, again, I said earlier, if you put something on a pedestal and you worship it, you end up losing that thing itself in the end. And so Bellbury is attempting to remake mankind. They're trying to be another Babel, Tower of Babel, and remake mankind. And in the end, well, I mean, I don't know if I should spoil it. Are we allowing spoilers on this maybe talk? I don't know. In the end, you'll see they lose. They lose things. They lose very important marks of their humanity.
Yeah.
Now, okay, this is a bit of a tangent, but I think that you're going to appreciate, well, actually not, but in the Enlightenment term of Old Western culture, Mitch Stokes has this great walking through the philosophy of Greeks up through the Enlightenment. And basically your point was that for these characters, they enthrone rationality, they enthrone reason, and in the end they can't keep it, they lose their reason, it defeats itself. That I think is actually not too dissimilar to the progression that happened in the Enlightenment, and this is all straight from Dr. Stokes, that the Enlightenment enthroned reason, and then all the philosophers started thinking, well, how do we know we can trust our senses? We have to base everything on reason. And then after a couple generations of that, they realized we can't trust our senses. There are limits to what we can know. And then they started realizing, wait, if we're trying to be completely reasonable about this, how do we even know that we can trust reason? And it sort of collapsed into this, we can't know anything outside of our own heads. So I think that's kind of along the same lines of, if you enthrone reason and put something above, too much emphasis on it, or then you end up losing it. And that's a way of looking at what happened in the Enlightenment even. So,
yeah.
Well, that's a good tangent. Connected.
So I'd like to make a plug for another podcast that I know you're going to be on at one point. So by the time this is released, perhaps we will have done that. But Valerie Abraham and Lydia Fugashan, my wife, are on their podcast, Muse and Hearth, would like to specifically zero in on the relationship with Mark and Jane Studdock and the role of femininity and masculinity and men without chests and those themes. So you can dig into that with them. So go subscribe to Muse and Hearth and listen to that episode.
If you're excited about digging more into the Ransom Trilogy, you should probably follow the Deeper Heaven Facebook page. I think that we have, you know, a Deeper Heaven Instagram's Facebook page, that kind of thing. You can buy the book, deeperheaven.com. We'll take you to the Roman Roads website. And subscribe for future podcasts and future conversations. Thank you for being on, Christiana.
Thank you for having me.
Christiana.
Anna. That's Christiana.
Thank you for listening to the Digressio podcast. Until next time, read your Bible, read a good book, and keep inheriting the humanities.